because I think a lot of people just think they can't be consistent. And then the other thing is, like, once you put yourself out there, like, that's the hardest part, is starting the workout. And it's like that for me to this day. Like, after we get off this podcast, it's going to be 10 o'clock at night, and I'm not going to feel like going into the gym, but I haven't done my lift yet today. And I don't feel like it, but I know once I get in there, I'm actually going to have fun, and I'm going to enjoy it.
Welcome to the Trailhead of Trail Runner Nation, where we go on virtual trail runs with interesting guests that help us learn a little bit about how to be better runners and hopefully better human beings. If this is your first time listening, we welcome you to the trail. We hope you have fun on this run, because today we're talking with Ryan Hall. He's a retired American long distance runner, and he just happens to hold the American marathon record at 2 hours, 4 minutes and 58 seconds, which he set all the way back in 2011. He's also the first American to break the 1 hour barrier in the half marathon at 59:43. And today he's going to teach us a little bit about running. I think he may have a few tips. Hope you enjoy it. Today's episode is sponsored by Exoskin. We love the fact that they're a veteran owned company, and all of their products are made right here in the good old USA. Hey, Don, let's discuss the 3.1 Exo underwear liners. They come in three lengths, and they're perfect for whether you're going trail running, hiking, biking, backpacking, and they're essential for race day.
Scott, you don't have to wait for one of those events to be comfortable. You can wear them anytime, any day, Scott. I know I do.
Exoskin has patented yarns that they've invented. And what does that mean for you? It means reduced friction, prevents chafing and hot spots, and it evaporates the moisture off your skin quickly.
They have more than just a 3.1 Exo underwear, Scott. They have socks, they have jerseys, they have shorts. They have a number of things that make this sport of ours possible.
You need to check them out. Go to exoskin.us, or better yet, get a 10% discount by going to trailrunnernation.com. Click on the deals, and you can get 10% off with the code TRN.
If you want a great deal from one of our partners, Inside Tracker, just go to our website, click on the deals page, and click on the Inside Tracker link to receive 20% off your entire order.
If you can't take it from us, if you don't trust Don, you don't trust me, trust Devin Yanko. She's been on our podcast before, and this is what she says. They're not looking for illness. They're looking for optimization. I'm a firm believer that their testing and approach have helped me strengthen my weakest links. And that's exactly what Inside Tracker does. They come in, take a blood sample, they test the blood against all these different biomarkers for endurance runners, and then they create a plan that you can follow, and then they keep you accountable. That's how you improve.
And if you want to do well on the outside, you've got to look on the inside, and you need to make sure everything is right.
If you want your deal, go to our website, trailrunnernation.com. Click on the deals at the very top of the page. Scroll down to Inside Tracker. There's a link there. If you click it, you can get 20% off the entire Inside Tracker store.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott War. And boy, are we stoked about this episode. We have one of the most prolific American living runners on the podcast. He's a retired American long distance runner. He holds the American marathon record at 204, which was set all the way back in 2011 at Boston. He also holds the American half marathon record. And this is Ryan Hall. Ryan, thanks for coming on, buddy.
Oh, yeah. Stoked to join you guys. Thanks for having me.
Did I just call him buddy?
I don't think you've ever called me buddy. And I've known you for years, Scott. So welcome, Ryan. It seems like you've just slipped right into Scott's inner circle. And it's very nice to have you.
Yeah, I'm good at making friends. I make friends quick.
Hey, Ryan, we love that you have challenged yourself. And one of the things I came across on social media is this crazy challenge that you did recently, where I think it's called Chop Wood, Carry Water. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this one was so much fun. And it actually meant a ton to me, too, because I grew up in Big Bear in Southern California, and I grew up to keep our house warm at night, we'd go out into the forest, me and my siblings and my dad. We go out into the forest and we cut this stuff. It's called ironwood because it's really heavy, really hard wood. And I just remember carting that wood up really steep slopes in the mountains with my brothers. We'd have competitions to see who could like carry the most wood. And we'd get that wood home. We'd be splitting it together and seeing who, you know, trading off hits to see who can break it, you know. So actually, like, chopping wood, carrying wood is when I like fell in love with doing hard things, which kind of set like the whole foundation for my entire pro running career, because that's what running's all about. It's like, you gotta love doing hard stuff. If you're going to be a runner, whether it's a ultra runner or a marathoner or a miler, like, you're going to be in a lot of pain during even the best races. And so you got to not just like know how to navigate the pain cave, but you have to actually like want to go into the pain cave. And so as a kid out in the forest in Big Bear is where I fell in love with the pain cave, and I love just pushing myself. I love getting my body to the point where I'm shaking and I literally just have to drop the wood on the ground because I can't take it another step, you know. So it was like my training ground for learning to push myself. And then, you know, the carry water aspect of the challenge, you know, my wife and I, we adopted four girls from Ethiopia. We spent a lot of time in Africa. We know how different life can be for people who are not in America, and how valuable a simple resource that we take for granted every day. We just go flip on the water and out it comes. And it's not like that for everyone, you know. So the challenge was to split a cord of wood at my house in Flagstaff, Arizona, and then drive from there out to the Grand Canyon. It's about 75-minute, 90-minute drive. And then to run down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon holding two empty 7-gallon jugs of water that weighed about 70 pounds each. When they're full, when they're empty, they're just like a pound or two. So going down the canyon, we're just cruising. It was super fun. That's actually one of my favorite runs I've ever done, is dropping down into the canyon. It was so beautiful, so much fun. But then when I got to the bottom, I filled up those water jugs in the Colorado River, and I hauled those jugs back out of the canyon. And that was, you know, a 5-mile, 5,000 feet of elevation gain haul out of there, which I'll never forget, for both like how hard it was physically and also just how stunning it was. Because by the time we were coming out of there, the stars were out, the moon was out, no one else was out there except for my crew. And it was just like one of those lifetime memories that I have, but also something that meant, you know, a lot to me for a lot of different reasons.
You know, I'm sure that trail is pretty populated. Did you get any weird looks as you're coming up the trail with two big jugs of water? They're thinking, hey, you know, there's a drinking fountain at the top, Ryan.
Yeah, no, it's funny. We actually ran into a park ranger, and she was like taking pictures of me carrying them. And she's like, I've seen a lot of crazy things in the canyon, but this is about the craziest of all of them. So yeah, it was pretty fun. It was definitely a little different than what people are used to, especially when you're running down carrying two empty water jugs. There was a lot of people on the way down, not so much on the way up. And everyone's like, why are you running down with empty water jugs?
Did you do anything special with that water when you got to the top? Are they still in the jugs, or did you spray each other with water for success? What happened?
Oh, that's a good idea, Don. We should have done that. No, I just dumped it out on the ground when I got to the top. I wasn't going to carry those water jugs even back to the car after that. I didn't carry those jugs for a while. I have since like gotten back into it, because I actually love farmer carries. It's a great exercise, even for runners. It's a lot of core stabilization. Obviously, it's a lot of trap and grip strength, which is usually, you know, not a strong suit for runners. At least it wasn't for me when I was running. But really, really good for the core. And it was honestly the hardest part of the challenge was the cardio aspect of it, because I hadn't been doing a lot of running. I'd been doing a lot of lifting, and like strength wise, I was good. My hands were good. All that was good. But it was just like doing intervals in an interval session for 5 hours at a time, because you just take these water jugs for like 30 seconds or however long you can take them, set it down, walk around for about 30 seconds and go again. And I think the way up, I might have taken like two kind of extended breaks, but for the most part, just like 5 hours straight of just carrying water. And you know, a lot of that is like, learning to stay present in what you're doing. I've always said, like, the hardest part of running a marathon is oftentimes the first mile, because it's so easy to psych yourself out. Because I've had marathons, like when I ran Chicago back in the day, where the first couple miles, I thought I was running like a 5 mile race. Like, it felt really fast. It felt really hard early on. And that's scary when you still have 20 plus miles to go, you know? So during those times when I'd find myself like getting anxious inside about how far I had to go and how hard this was going to be, I always just had to bring myself back to the present moment. And, you know, a lot of people talk a lot about that, but that was, you know, one of the tactics that I used as a pro runner that was super helpful for me, and something that I had to pull out for that challenge as well, where it's like, don't look too far up the road. Don't worry about how hard it is. Like, just do this carry and do a good job with this carry. And then we'll worry about the next one when we get to the next one, because you can really psych yourself out when you're trying to take on some big challenges.
Well, boy, Scott's going to have a question here about how you prepared for that. I know that's what he was thinking. That's why I raised my hand to interrupt him, because I want to put this as a future question so that we don't get past this. And it's on all three of us to remember this. How do you stay in the present moment when you're running? That's really a skill. And I would love to hear how Ryan Hall has done that and practiced it, and how you teach it to the people that you train. So let's remember that conversation. Scott, go with your question.
No, I think we should answer that question right now, because it's a perfect question. And I'm going to put a little caveat in there.
Yeah.
Ryan Hall wrote a book called Run the Mile You're In. And I bet you there's some correlation there, that where he dives deep into the answer there. But Ryan, go ahead and answer that question. I'm sitting on the edge of my chair right now.
Yeah, no, that is a great question. And actually, I might share something that's not even in my book. I didn't talk about this aspect of it, but when Don was asking the question, it kind of popped into my mind, so I'll share it. You know, oftentimes when I'm running marathons, people are like, what are you thinking about the whole time you're out there? You know, because you're out there competing for 2+ hours. There's no music. I mean, you have crowd support and stuff like that. But what's funny is I've never been bored in a marathon, ever. And I think why that is because I'm focused on largely like the sensation of running, the sensation that I'm experiencing. And when you're focused on the sensation, you can't be anywhere else but there. And that's like one of the sweetest parts of sports altogether, is just like that being present. You know, we have so many things in our life that are pulling us in so many different directions now, that it's a rare treat to actually just be in the middle of what you're doing and feel it, and feel all the feelings associated with it. You know, so oftentimes when I'm out there running, I'm like trying to coach myself to be as relaxed as possible. Like, that's like key number one, relaxation. Anytime I tighten up, or I think anyone tightens up, you get tight, your body's restricted, you're not performing optimally. So a lot of times it's about like staying relaxed, trying to fall asleep. I say this to my athletes all the time. I'm like, just put yourself in a trance, stare at the guy's back and just fall asleep. Your goal is to get to 20 miles of this marathon, spending as little energy as humanly possible. So, you know, I'm never bored out there. And I think that's largely because I'm just focused on like, what sensations am I feeling in my body? Can I get my shoulders to relax a little bit more? Can I have my hands nice and chill? Can I feel my face bouncing up and down? Like, I'm focused on what is happening in my body and how can I get it all to relax as much as possible and just flow out of me, rather than trying to like force this thing to happen. And trying harder does not help in running. It's got to just flow out of you. And that's why when you see some of these guys run the best performances, you know, Kipchoge, he makes it look easy, right? Like, that guy never looks tired at the end. That's because his fitness is just flowing out of him the whole time. So that's, you know, that's the goal. And there's always challenges in races that get you out of that state. But when I was running my best, it was just all about like focusing on the sensation.
So if I was, and I have to ask, what other sensations do you think are relevant that you've learned to listen to? And I'll just throw a couple out there, just about, you know, metabolism, your body, your sweat rate, your breathing, your heart rate. There's a lot of biometrics that are going on that you're constantly juggling and watching, besides your face going up and down and shoulders back. I've got to think where you're landing on your foot. You are very, very busy managing these sensations. Speak to that if you would.
Yeah, you know, I think I've spent my entire running career learning where my threshold is for given distances, you know, and threshold is a word that we throw out in running all the time. And a lot of people are confused by it. But really, if you think about threshold, it's just like the entranceway to a door, right? And you cross over the threshold and you're now in a different room. It's the same thing with running. Like, what is the threshold level that I can sustain for the marathon distance, which is different than the threshold level I can sustain for the half marathon distance? And then learning, okay, so I'm gonna be running this marathon for 2+ hours. What is the maximum amount of energy I can put out the entire time without tanking myself, right? And so a lot of it, and you learn this in training. You don't learn this out on the race course. So like, for example, when I set the American record in the half marathon, I went out way faster than my coach and I had talked about. But what was happening in those first couple miles is I was just I didn't actually close my eyes, but in my mind's eye, I was just like, okay, if I was doing a 1 hour threshold in Mammoth, where I was training at the time, could I sustain this energy level for that amount of time? And the answer was yes. And so even though my watch was telling me I was running too fast, I don't know what was going on with my heart rate because I wasn't tracking that. This was, you know, pre like wrist heart rate days. I just had a good old fashioned Timex and I'd hit split every time I'd come through the mile marker. It was just all about that. Just like find that threshold and just park it there. And for me, I kind of know when I'm at that threshold by knowing that I can actually recover while I'm running. So I'll put it like right there and I might feel like, dude, I'm about to pop. I'm about to like slow down significantly here. But then can I like keep the same pace, the same effort again through relaxation and actually like recover as I'm running? Then I know I'm good. You know, if I get to the point where it's just getting harder and harder and harder and like I'm like just redlining it, then I know I'm not going to be able to sustain that for a longer distance. Of course, it matters like what stage of the race you're in and how far you're racing and all that. But a lot of it is just like learning your threshold and learning to just park it right there.
You know, that, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. One of my favorite things about trail running and longer distance, longer time stuff is that moment of honesty with yourself. You're out there running and you're thinking, you know what? I'm moving along pretty swift. This is going good. I could do this for a while. But then you have to ask yourself, I have 4 hours of this left. Can I do this for 4 hours? And the answer comes at you instantly. No, I can't. Then you need to back it off. You don't fool yourself. Don't cheat everything because you probably know the answer. Your brain is very good at predicting the outcomes if you listen to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been saying a lot to my athletes, especially my track athletes who are coming off the track and have really good wheels. I tell them, like, just let yourself feel good for a long time if you're racing a half or a marathon. And those guys aren't as accustomed to doing that because usually on the track, say if you're racing an 800 or a mile, if you're feeling really good, it probably means you're not running hard enough. So usually like that's a sign that you need to run harder. But, you know, in the marathon, you can't do that. It's got to feel... Like I said, I've had days where it felt fast from the beginning, but it still, even though it felt fast, it was still like sustainable, you know? So I think that's a good question to ask yourself while you're out there. Like, is this sustainable for, the given terrain and distance and course and all of that?
Yeah, I've had this experience. If I'm not a golfer, but if I were a golfer and I could imagine you get out there and you swing and it goes perfect. Your form felt good. You hit the ball right. It made a different sound and it went straight and further than anything you've ever hit. And you keep chasing that swing day after day that you play golf. You're looking for it again. And I felt at one point when I was in shape at a point that I removed myself from my body and I was just an observer to this body running. I wasn't even in it physically making it go. I just lifted away from it and I was watching it effortlessly move. And I said, wow, that's the spot. That felt good. And it was unique.
Yeah.
For me anyway.
And that's when most people experience that runner's high that we talk about so much, you know, when it's just flowing. And you know what's funny about that is like, for as much as we try and time that to happen in the biggest races, some of my sweetest moments in running were just like out in the forest, just running through the forest and just having that flow state experience. And that's really like the highlight of running for me is that sensation of just floating along, just eating up the ground.
Hey, Ryan, I want to get into one of the races that I don't know where you rank this on your list of best races. Unfortunately, you didn't podium at the Beijing Olympics, but I've read a story about your experience at the Beijing Olympics and the lessons that you learned there. Can you talk a little bit about that experience, how it unraveled, and then what lessons you learned there?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I was coming off running really well at the London Marathon. I just hit a PR and ran 2:06. I think I can't remember what place it was, 5th, 6th, 7th, one of those. but, you know, I was racing as the best guys in the world there. So I really, you know, had the ambition of trying to go after a medal. And that was my expectation going into the race. And I learned a valuable lesson. You know, we were getting lots of help from various people through our Olympic committee and stuff, telling us about the weather and the conditions. You know, Beijing's gonna be hot and humid, and everyone's saying it's gonna be slow, it's gonna be slow, it's gonna be slow. And so you get that in your mind, you know, just expecting like to jog off the start line. And then Sammy Wanjiru just takes off from the beginning, from the very first step. And it was like he just like caught us with an uppercut, like just coming out of the bell in boxing, you know, like no one, I was not ready for that. Unless he told other people, like, I don't think many people were ready for that. And so I found myself early on in that race back in like 50th place or maybe even further back than that. And here I am trying to podium, you know, and I can't even see the leaders. And I see the helicopter that's following the leaders just going off out in the distance, you know.
Wow.
And it was one of those deals where I'm sure like all runners can relate to this, when you had high expectations for a race, you're not having your day, and then you start throwing a little pity party, you know, you're like, why is this happening to me? And you can think about all the negative things. It's like, this is the one day out of my entire career that I want to be on and I'm not on, and these other guys are on, and you can really start feeling sorry for yourself. And so, you know, like, I'm a very spiritual person. I love like praying, talking to God when I'm running and stuff. And I was just I started asking God questions. I was like, I wasn't even asking him questions. I was just complaining. I was just like, I'm so frustrated right now. Why is this happening? What's going on? Start blaming it on God even, you know, like, you did this to me. But what I felt like he was telling me to do, and I hated this advice. This is the last thing I felt like doing, but I felt like he's just encouraging me to start encouraging people around me and just start reaching out to other people and talking to them. So I did not feel like doing that, but whenever I'd catch a guy, I just started with just a few words, you know, be like, hey, good job, man, doing good. And at first I was just kind of faking it. I didn't really feel it, you know? But then eventually, as I was continuing to do that and catching guys, I started to get more into it and like really wanting the best for the other guys out there and being like, hey, dude, let's work together. We can get this group up in front of us, you know? And as I started encouraging other people, what was happening is I was getting outside of myself. So what's happening when you're focused on your own pain? You're just focused on yourself. And so you're going to experience more of what you're experiencing inside. And I was experiencing pain, discomfort, frustration, all these negative things. And the minute that I look to someone else and be like, hey, how can I help this other person? How can I encourage this other person? It got me outside of myself and I started feeling better. And so, you know, I went from like 50th and was just picking off guy after guy and working together with guys around me and worked myself into 10th place. And, you know, it wasn't my best race of my career, finishing 10th in the Olympics. Like I said, I'd hoped to finish higher than that. It definitely wasn't the day physically when I was at my best, but it was one of those life lessons that you learn through running that just is with you forever, that I'll never forget, about like the power of getting outside of yourself when you are in your own pain and your own discomfort. And it's not what you feel like doing. At least it wasn't for me. I really, you know, you feel like being selfish in those moments and just thinking about yourself and having a pity party with yourself, but that's not a helpful thing to do. So I really kind of like just found a little key there that I still use to this day when I'm struggling, you know. I'd be like, okay, I'm struggling. Maybe I need to go serve someone else or help someone else or just get out. I need to do something to get outside of myself.
It helps even in life when you're not wearing a bib. That same lesson, you know, moves all the way through life and just helping people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how good would this world be if when we were in pain, our reaction was to help other people, you know, instead of like lashing out against other people?
It'd be a different place.
I love that. And that's one of the characteristics I think that I've seen, or at least the one that keeps me in trail running, is it seems like that is it permeates the whole trail culture. When you're out there on a long, whether it's a 10K, whether it's a, you know, a half marathon or a 50K or whatever longer race, you're going to have bad spots. And if you can remember that lesson that Ryan just talked about, those bad spots are going to shorten. You're going to get past them, and you're going to have more fun out there. So thank you for sharing that. I love that story, Ryan. Thank you.
Yeah. It reminds me actually of one time this happened to me in a trail race. I was running the Grand Traverse trail race in Crested Butte, and it was 45 miles, I think. But at one point in the later stages of the race, I didn't train at all for it. I hadn't run in like 3 months, so I was ill-prepared. And I was just like suffering through the last like 20 miles. It was just getting ugly. But I remember this one time, this girl, she was having this IT band problem, and she was kind of just like limping really bad out there. And I was like, hey, what's going on? And so I stopped and I showed her some stretches and stuff and tried to encourage her a little bit. But I love that about the trail running scene. It is very much like we're all in this together. That's like one of my favorite things about trail running. But funny thing is then like, so I kept going on, and then she ended up like catching me with like a mile to go and like 5 feet past me.
You should have pulled up that. You should have had a cramp or something. She could have paid you back and you could have then raced her to the finish.
I don't think there's anything she could have done for me at that stage of the race.
Hey, Ryan, one of the things that I am most interested in talking to you about, and I'm sure you get this question all the time, but we're going to approach it with a little bit of a little differently, hopefully. And that is, you've made a massive change in your physical appearance, right? I believe when you were racing professional, you were like 135 pounds. You look like just a beanpole marathon runner. Once you retired, you changed your physique, and now you're 200, 190, 200 pounds of pure muscle. You can be on Men's Fitness magazine. My question to you is, and I think that we can all relate to this, or maybe could relate to this, you changed your physical appearance. So there's a whole thing of amazing how adaptable the body is and pliable the body is. But my question to you is, why did you want to? Your identity as a runner is this. You look in the mirror and you're 135 pound, lean, mean running machine. What made you say, you know what, I want to change?
Yeah, there was a lot of things. I'll tell you, the biggest thing was probably just, I felt like it's what my body was craving and needing, you know, because, you know, the way that you have to approach running, if you're trying to be amongst the best marathoners in the world, is you're right on that razor's edge in terms of like, it's not a necessarily healthy lifestyle to live. You know, like I was significantly underweight compared to how I'd be as a normal person, you know, so that's not particularly healthy for your hormones and things like that. And then you're training twice a day and you're redlining these workouts, taking them as far as you can, the intensity level super high. Like there is a really healthy, balanced way to do running, but I wouldn't say you can necessarily be healthy and balanced if your goal is to be amongst the best runners in the world. Especially if, like myself, it's funny, I was telling someone this the other day, it's like when I was running, I was always known as like the big guy. And now I'm into like strength and lifting. And I'm known as like a little strength athlete. I just felt like my body just needed me to give back to it, because I had been taking a lot of withdrawals for like a 20-year period of time, demanding a ton of my body, and it needed me to like do something that wasn't catabolic, something that was anabolic, and it was going to build my body back up, get it strong. Because I'll tell you what, like, I felt good when I was running as a pro athlete, but then the rest of the day, I'm pretty tired, like, the whole day, just kind of dragging around, taking 2-hour naps every single afternoon, sleeping every night for like 9-10 hours, and just tired all the time, pretty much. So it was so nice to like get away from that when I retired from pro running, get into the lifting. And then, you know, I just love, kind of like you were saying, Scott, I love seeing what the body's capable of doing. And I was really curious, you know, cause I do have like good genetics for distance running. Like everyone in my family has a quote unquote big engine, you know, like aerobically, like we don't have to work very hard and we're pretty, pretty strong aerobically, but we are not big people. We're not naturally big, strong people. You know, sometimes you see people walking around, you're like, dude, you must be in the gym all the time. They're like, no, I never lift. It's just like how I so we're not those kind of people, but I was super curious to like go into something that I wasn't gifted at and see how far I could take it and see what my body can do. And, you know, I never had any ambitions of being like, I'm going to, you know, pull the world record for the deadlift or squat, or, you know, like I know like the genetic component is very real in all sports, but especially in lifting. I think it's really, really strong. So, you know, but I wanted to see how far I could take it and continue to experiment, continue to have fun. And then a big part too is just staying true to who I am. Like I was telling you as a kid, like I fell in love with pushing myself in the forest, carrying wood, and I can no longer do that in the running space. I was just really fatigued, really tired. I couldn't even finish an easy 30-minute run for like months on end. So my body was just gone when it came to running. But there's here's the thing about life is like, there's always other activities to do, other stuff to do, other adventures to be had. So I just had to find a different way to meet that very real need that I have as my own personality is to need to physically push myself on a regular basis. And so I met that need through lifting. And it was funny because I hated lifting when I was running. I would just get through the gym as quick as I could. I hated lifting. But then once I got into it, when I retired from pro running, now, you know, I probably have only missed a dozen days in 6 years, 6+ years. So I love it now. But I do miss getting outside, which is why it's nice to couple it with some running, some adventure runs through the mountains, some stuff that takes me outside, because that's where I want to be. I want to be outside more than anywhere else.
We talked about adventures that you create, and one of them happens to combine two of your passions, running and heavy lifting. We came across something. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So this challenge was a tough one. So 500-pound deadlift straight into a sub-5-minute mile. I assume this is what you're talking about, Don. Am I on the money?
Yeah, yeah. Yep, that's it. Yep.
So, yeah, one of my friends had sent me a video of this guy who did it. And he's like, I think you can do this. And at the time, my deadlift PR was like 440 or something. I was like, I don't know. I got a long ways to go to hit 500, you know? But then my deadlift just started shooting up and I was like, oh yeah, maybe I can do this. So the thing that's hard about this challenge is the time starts when you first touch the bar for the deadlift. So you have to pull the 500 pounds. So you take all the weight out to the track and then you set it up on the track. As soon as you touch the bar, the timer starts and then you got to finish the deadlift and a mile, all of that under 5 minutes.
Oh,
so I made the mistake of attempting this in Big Bear Lake where I grew up on the track that I ran my first ever mile race at. So it had a ton of significance to me, but the problem is it was at 7,000 feet in the middle of summer. It's pretty hot and I was just suffering. I found it's funny. I'm really good at altitude. I've lived at altitude most of my life. I tend to do really well at higher altitudes, but I found as I gotten bigger, I've gotten less good at altitude. So I think that was the big mistake I made on that one. I pulled the deadlift and then I ran a 5:22. Well, my time for the entire thing was 5:22. But that is one I'd like to go back and try that one again at some point. So yeah, I'm gonna have to revisit that. I'm not successful in all of my challenges that I take on, which is good, you know?
Yeah.
Cause that means that you're really pushing the boundaries. You really aren't sure if you can do it or not. And sometimes you can't.
Scott, I think you and I could pull that off. We'd do a team lift, so we'd both be on the bar, and then we'd hop on our bikes, and I think we could get it done.
if I had an e-bike.
All right, since we're making the rules, that's cool.
We're going to take a break from this great discussion with Ryan Hall to tell you about something we think is important. And that is one of our partners, Athletic Greens.
Just one scoop has 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source superfood, probiotics, and adaptogens. What it really means, Scott, is that the beginning of your day starts with the things your body needs.
It's so easy. One scoop, cold bottle water, shake it up, and I get all of the nutrients I need and without thinking about it. Athletic Greens has a deal for Trail Runner Nation members. Not only will you get the Athletic Greens, but you'll also get a free one-year supply of the immune-supporting vitamin D, and you'll get 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you need to do is go to athleticgreens.com/trailrunnernation. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/trailrunnernation. Or what? You know what else you can do, Don? You can go to trailrunnernation.com, click on what?
The deals page, Scott. It's right at the top of the page. We all know that.
Exactly. Scroll down to the Athletic Greens and the link is there.
Now let's get back to Ryan Hall. This is a fantastic conversation.
Hey, Ryan, one of the things that I find fascinating is how important strength training is to running. Do you think that it's more important now that you've been concentrating on strength training? Because here you attempted a sub 5 minute mile with a deadlift. So the actual running was way under 5 minutes. Did you do any running training for that? Or could you go out right now? Let's say there's no deadlift. Could you go out to the track right now and run a sub 5 minute mile?
I would be close right now. Yeah. I've gotten more into rowing as of late. So my MVO2 max is probably a little bit higher than it usually is. But like, for example, I remember one time I went for like 6 months where I didn't go for one run, and all I was doing is lifting every day in the gym, and I was bulking, trying to put on size and strength. And then I was just in the gym one day and I was like, I'm just going to hop on a treadmill and see how fast I can run a mile right now. And I couldn't break five. I was like 5:18 or something like that. And that was at sea level. But that's the kind of, like I was saying, when you're genetically gifted at something, you don't have to work super hard at it. So like when I was training for that challenge, I was having to spend way more time in the gym than actually running. But it's funny though, because I got the deadlift, I just didn't get the run part. So maybe I needed to spend more time running.
Hey, I've got a quick question on that. So you say you're doing primarily rowing, and your VO2 max is high right now and where you want it. Do you think you can substitute running with some type of other cardiovascular activity and have it translate to that? So maybe I can't run, but I'm riding the bike all the time, and maybe I'm swimming a lot, but I haven't been able to run. Can I use my swimming and my biking and then feel like I've got something in my tank for the run?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of cross training, which is funny because, during my time at Stanford, I had a number of injuries and stuff. And the whole guys team, like, we never cross trains. Like, if you get hurt, you just stop doing everything. And then you come back and you're in terrible shape and it takes forever to get back in shape. Whereas, like, the girls were really diligent with their cross training. And I've actually learned a lot from my wife, Sarah, who's also running professionally, about this, because I've seen the fitness gains she gets through cross training. So now it's something I utilize a lot with my athletes that I'm coaching, is we'll do like a hard morning workout and then come back in the afternoon, do another hard cross training workout. The nice thing about cross training workouts is, depending on what you're choosing to do, you don't have the impact. So your risk of injury goes way down, but you're still building the engine. You know, you're still getting a really big aerobic hit. So even when my athletes are healthy, I have them utilizing cross training. And I've seen Sarah come back from injuries that took her out for a number of months, and she came back in better shape than she was before she got hurt because she was cross training so hard. There's things you can do cross training that you can't do in running. In running, you don't really stack, at least I don't, and I don't do this with my athletes. I don't stack hard efforts on top of each other. You know, I've heard like guys who do comrades and stuff like that might stack like long runs together, and that's cool, you know, but for us, we're operating at such high intensity levels that you don't stack workouts. But in cross training, you can, because you don't have the impact on the body and the muscles. It hits it differently. Now, you can't just like just cross train and not do any running. That's going to be tough. But you can really build a huge engine through cross training. So I'm a big, big fan of that.
Cool.
You know, you mentioned when you were running, you did go to the gym, but you didn't like it. I'm trying to remember if I listened to an interview with you where you or I read something where you talked about how strength can help improve your stride length. So at some point you can't improve your turnover rate, but if you improve your strength, you can get, you know, an extra inch or 3 inches out of your stride at the same turnover and increase your speed. Can you talk to a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what weight training does is it allows you to put more force into the ground. If you can put more force into the ground, you're going to get more float phase of your stride. You know, you're going to have a bigger stride because you're pushing off harder. That's why, like, if you look at a lot of pictures, still pictures of marathon runners who are elite runners, you'll see a lot of the guys have both feet in the air where they're in that float phase. And they're in that float phase for quite a long time because their stride is so long. But you can't just do that by trying to have a longer stride. Then you're going to overstride. You know, the force is going to be coming back the other direction right at you, and you're going to be worse, you know? So you don't want to just be like, I'm just going to force myself to have bigger. The bigger stride has to come through impacting the ground and pushing through the ground. And so when you have more power in your legs, you can do that really well. So that's why I like lifts like hex bar deadlift, single leg step ups, anything where it's about loading pressure and force into the ground is going to be super applicable to running. And it was crazy. Like haven't done a ton of running since I've retired, and I've not worked on my sprint speed pretty much at all, but I'm way faster sprinting now at 40 years old than I was when I was running professionally because I have so much more power in my legs. Now I'm not better at distance running, you know, it's a totally different game when it comes to distance running. So the distance runner, they have to look for that sweet spot where it's like they have power in their legs, they're strong, but then they're not carrying around a bunch of extra body mass that's going to slow them down at the same time. So, you know, if I was back down, if I could have this kind of power in my legs that I have right now and weigh the same thing as when I was running professionally, that would be fun.
That would be a fun experiment.
Oh man, I'd have to diet down so hard now.
Hey, one of the things that as a professional runner running, you know, most of your life, you have to maintain consistency. And I know that a lot of people, me included, have these ebbs and flows with consistency. Can you talk to us a little bit about consistency? How can we maintain or achieve better consistency in our training?
Yeah. You know, I actually listened to a podcast that was kind of not exactly about this, but I really took some things away from it that were super helpful. I can't remember the name of the podcast right now. It's kind of eluding me, but the main message of it was like, make it easy to be consistent. And they were talking about goals. They're like, make it easy to hit your goals, set goals that are really attainable. And then when you meet those goals, celebrate it every single time, every little victory you get, like even if it's some ridiculous, like just dancing in front of the mirror and you're in your bathroom by yourself, like do something to celebrate it. And actually my dad, he really did a great job of instilling that value in me as a kid. Every time I'd hit a PR in a track meet, we'd always like go out and get a smoothie or get an ice cream or something. You know, he's like, we got to celebrate all the little victories. Cause if you don't allow yourself to celebrate it, then you get to a point where like, it's just not worth it. Like I'm achieving, achieving, achieving. I'm never getting to an end here. and I can't even enjoy it because I'm always going after the next thing. Like, you have to allow yourself to be like, hey, good job, man. You did it. Like, way to go. Like, give yourself credit. You know, it's super, super important. And then just, again, making sure that what you're going after is easy to do, and then build from there. When you've been consistent and it's a habit after a month or two, then try to take off a little bit more, you know, take a little bit of a bigger bite, take it a little bit further. But you can also, you can get so much done with consistency. Like when I did that chop wood, carry water challenge, all I did was 20 minutes every other day. That was it. And my thing was, like, I never have an excuse why I can't fit in a 20-minute farmer carry. And there were times where I'd get back late at night, I'd put on my headlamp, and I'd go out into the forest in the middle of the night by myself. But I was like, 20 minutes, that's nothing. And then from that 20 minutes, I was able to carry some those water jugs for 5+ hours.
You know, I was listening to a podcast somewhere. In fact, it was this one, and I can't remember where we heard it, Scott, and which episode. But it was about the first 10 minutes of any run is the most valuable 10. I think that came from David Roche. And
yeah.
Yep. And so getting out there and getting the maximum benefit happens in the first 10 minutes. So who doesn't have 10 minutes to go out there and capture maximum benefit? And I think that mindset is great.
Hey Ryan, I will tell you, I haven't quite copyrighted this, but I haven't made hats yet, but I keep threatening to. The equation one is greater than nothing. If you can get out and do something and you can celebrate that, to your point, you're achieving something. And everybody can get out and do something. If you're a runner and you're finding trouble with consistency, you know, I learned this from, like Don said, from David Roche, who coached me for a while. Get out, you can do 10-minute run. You can go out and do 10 minutes. You can run around the block twice in 10 minutes. And that's going to be better than nothing. You achieve something psychologically. You're saying, I am consistent, and celebrate that. So anyway, you were going to say something. I interrupted you. Sorry.
No. I was just piggybacking off that. You know, it's like you do that, you're consistent, and then you give yourself credit for it. And then you're just instilling this value inside of yourself that, yeah, like I can be successful. Cause I think a lot of people just think they can't be consistent. And then the other thing is, like, once you put yourself out there, like, that's the hardest part, is starting the workout. And it's like that for me to this day. Like, after we get off this podcast, it's going to be 10 o'clock at night, and I'm not going to feel like going into the gym, but I haven't done my lift yet today. And I don't feel like it, but I know once I get in there, I'm actually going to have fun and I'm going to enjoy it. But you got to kick yourself in the pants to get out there. And so that's why I love, like, yeah, 10 minutes. Get out there and you'll probably feel better than you think you're going to feel. You'll have fun. You'll probably take it even further than that just because you're enjoying yourself.
Well, you got to get back. You ran 10 out. You got to run the 10 back. That's how that happens, Ryan.
Okay. Hey, we don't want to keep you from the gym any longer. I want to discuss something has nothing to do with running, or maybe it does. Get a little more personal, and if you don't mind talking about it. I love the story that you adopted these four girls from Ethiopia. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can you talk about that and let us know a little bit more? So far, I found out that Ryan, you know, if you listen back to the beginning of the podcast, I erroneously called Ryan my buddy. But I think you are now. I think you've developed into a buddy of mine. I want to know a little bit more about Ryan and these girls and how you and Sarah did this.
Yeah. Well, what's crazy is, like, you know, a lot of this just flows from life lessons that I've learned through running, you know. And I, one thing I was able to recognize after I finished running, or even no, while I was still running, was to not make fear-based decisions, to run out of, like, a way that I wanted to run, because I love to run that way. And the example I have real quick on that is just, I remember one time, like, everyone was telling me, like, you shouldn't touch the lead of the marathon, you should just tuck in. But I always loved going to the front. I love leading, even though you're breaking the wind for the other guys and theoretically it's not as fast. But if you're excited in the front, I bet you it's faster. Mm-hmm. But one year, yeah, I was running New York, and I kind of just, again, let, like, other people get in my head. And I was like, yeah, I'm just going to tuck in, be patient. And I was just not excited out there at all. And there was physical things going on as well. But after that race, and I still ran well, I still finished like fourth, but that was the year Meb won actually. But I was in the best shape of my life going into that race. And I just felt kind of like off the whole time, you know? And I realized, I was like, yeah, I let fear get inside of me and change how I operated and how I did things. So to fast forward to our story of adopting the four girls, you know, Sarah and I have always had a heart for adoption. We always wanted to build our family through adoption. And then the timing was starting to get right. I was feeling more ready. She was feeling more ready. And we were in Ethiopia training a lot. And we saw all these kids on the street just coming up to me asking to shine my shoes for like 10 cents. Mm-hmm. Your heart just breaks for these kids. You know, you just want them to have the same kind of opportunities that we have. And you know, you can't rescue everyone. You can't, you know, eliminate the problem instantly. But you can do something, you know. And that's, you know, running taught me that too. It's like taking one step, running 1 mile isn't going to do a whole lot, but I gotta take the next step, and I gotta keep putting all those steps together. And eventually when you put all those steps together, you put 500,000 of them together and you're running a 204 marathon, you know? So those each step is important. So we wanted to do something. We had a heart for the country, for the people. We love the culture there. And so we decided we're going to try to adopt one infant girl, which just kind of made sense. You know, usually everyone starts with one kid unless you have twins or something like that. And so we started the process. We're like number like 76 on a wait list, and the wait list just isn't even moving, you know? And, so we're doing that. And while we're there, we're training in Ethiopia. We visit some of the orphanages, and then we meet all these older children who are there just waiting for families. Mm-hmm. After interacting with the kids and playing with them, I was like, I would adopt any one of these kids, you know, like they're such great kids. And it just felt so weird that here we are, and not to put any, you know, adopting infants is great as well. I'm not saying that's not needed and not good. But for us, like after meeting these kids, we're just like, why do we not just change up our paperwork and decide to adopt an older kid? So that's what we decided to do. And it was during that time that we learned about four girls who were all biological sisters, and they couldn't find a home for them. They'd been looking for like 3 years, and they were talking about splitting the kids up and sending two with one family, two with another family, like in different countries. Like they probably never would have saw each other again. And I'm in the middle of five kids, and I was like, I could not be imagine growing up without my brothers and sisters. Like that's like, it breaks my heart just to think about it, you know? So, you know, we were thinking about it, praying about it, talking about it a lot. And I just felt like the only reason to not adopt the girls was because of my own fear, you know, my own fear of like, can we handle this? Can I handle this? This is gonna be a huge transition going from zero kids to four kids. Like there's just a lot of fear involved when you're making that kind of commitment to anyone or anything, you know, like you really, it's, you weigh the costs and you look at yourself and you're like, am I capable of this? But then when I focused on like my love for the girls, we'd met them, we'd hung out with them. When I focused on the love, I was like, I have that. And that's what's most important. So I want to live my life ideally. And again, I don't always do this, but I want to try and live out of a heart of love, not out of a heart of fear. So we decided to adopt our girls. That was 6 years ago now. And they're ages, when we adopted them, they're ages 5, 7, 11, and 15. So they're all, you know, 6 years older. We have one off in college, one that's going off to college next year. So we're only like 6 years away from being empty nesters, which is crazy to think about considering we've never even had an infant in our house. But
so there's an advantage to adopting one that's already, you know, a few years old. Quick empty nesting.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. And like built-in babysitters too. Like they've always been like the babysitting age. I've never changed a diaper. I think I've been woken up like once in the night. So yeah, in a lot of ways it can be, it kind of feels like we cheated a little bit when I see my siblings going through the infant stage and they're just super tired from being up all night, you know? So, but no, our kids are great. We're just super blessed. You know, they're just great kids. We're just super grateful for them.
That's such a beautiful story, Ryan. So, and I know inspired other people will be inspired to reach out and live through their heart and not out of fear. And that's a great, great lesson. So thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, Ryan, we really appreciate you coming on. We hope that maybe we may have tickled your fancy and we may have you on again sometime because we've really enjoyed this conversation.
Because Scott's your buddy.
And when I email you, you can say, I'll just say, hey, it's your buddy. You want to come back on the podcast?
That's what buddies do, right?
That's right.
Hey, and we're actually very lucky that you've kind of transitioned yourself from these hard road marathons to this easy cakewalk in the mountain trail runs. Mm-hmm. And part of our community, we greet you with open arms. And if we could ever catch up to you, we'd congratulate you for being part of our community. Mm-hmm. I know that yesterday you turned 40. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I celebrated by doing a big mountain run out in Crested Butte with my best buddy. And we were not setting any records out there. It was funny because I had my Garmin on and it was like I was getting all these new PR alerts. And it said, like, I got a new PR for the half marathon and it was like 6 hours.
Well, one of the things that we say in the trail community is, you know, when you run a marathon, let's say you're just an average Joe and you go run a marathon, the first question people ask is, what was your time? Because everybody knows 26.2, they know what is a good time. What's the, you know, everybody knows the 2 hour is like world record. Yeah. 3 hour, you're screaming fast. 4 hour, you're pretty in shape. And so everybody asks, what's your time? When you go out and run, let's say a 50K trail race, the first question they ask is, are you crazy? They have no comprehension of what time it takes. So we kind of, even though we do love our Garmins and our Coroses and our wearable computers on our wrists, we don't pay attention to them much. It's more just so that we can post on Strava and gloat a little bit.
The only time we're referring to is, did you have a good time? And we don't worry about the what's on the watch, what's it saying.
I love that.
I mean, I feel like trail runners like are doing it right that way. You know, like I ran the London Marathon, went right past like all these historic landmarks. I didn't see one thing when I was running. I was so focused on what I was doing, you know, and there's a time and place for that. But I love now out in the forest. It's like we're stopping, we're jumping in lakes, we're looking for caves, we're climbing up little cliffs. We're just out there just like little kids just playing. That's really, I mean, it's hard to beat that. It's pretty sweet. Like, you know, like I said, there's a time and place for performance and putting your head down and going hard at something, but it's pretty fun when you can just enjoy the ride too.
Hey, final question for people to understand who Ryan Hall is. You're in Toronto right now. Tell us what you're doing in Toronto.
Yeah, one of my athletes, Rory Linkletter, he's racing marathon tomorrow. He's one of the top Canadian runners. He actually has a national record in the half marathon. So he's running tomorrow. So I'm up here coaching him, supporting him. I'll be out on the bike tomorrow, biking around the course, trying to catch him as many times as I can and just cheering him on. And that's been super fun for me now. You know, I have a little group of pro athletes and Flagstaff that I'm coaching. I coach my wife as well. And then me and my buddy started online training, Run Free Training. And we're just stoked to be able to help as many people as possible and broaden my reach. You know, I feel like I've learned so much throughout my career and made so many mistakes. Every time that I help someone else not make the same mistakes that I made, I feel like I'm kind of redeeming myself, you know, like that's the only way I know how to redeem stuff where you look back and you're like, man, that was stupid. Why'd I do that? Really messed that up. But then you help someone else avoid that same pitfall. And it's like, well, that served a purpose now. Now that's helped other people. It's kind of like a way to get back at your failures.
We're going to leave a lot of links in the show notes, links to ryanandsarahhall.com, links to his blog, links to the runfreetraining.com website. We're actually going to have the video of the chop wood, carry water YouTube video. I think that'd be kind of fun for people to watch. And of course, follow Ryan on Instagram at ryanhall3. There's a lot of Ryan Halls, I guess. This one is Ryan Hall 3. So make sure you're following him or else you're going to learn something about quilting from another Ryan Hall. Ryan, hey, thanks for joining us. We really enjoyed this conversation and we hope you come back sometime.
I'd love to, you guys. It was a pleasure chatting with you guys.
All right. Now go out and run.
Mas.
And now we've reached the end of the podcast, really the finish line, Scott, where we give high fives as we're coming through the big arch. And we're going to thank our executive producer and editor, Ryan Warr.
And our social media guru, Yana Gibalova.
And our website graphic engineer, Katie Burke.
We also want to thank the Patreon supporters. If you want to become one, you can go to our website, hit the support us tab, and you can sign up on our Patreon channel. We also want to thank our business Patreon member, Doug Crumley. Doug Crumley is a coach for your finances. He is a private wealth advisor with Crumley & Associates, which is a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC. When you have the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Visit him at www.dougcrumleyjr.com.
Scott, we mentioned the deals page quite often. That's on our website, trailrunnernation.com. And we've made a lot of changes there, and we're really proud of it.
There's a lot of information there. Of course, there's the deals page where you can get all sorts of discounts on gear that we love and trust. We also have all of our other podcasts. We also have the Training Principles link. So we just started the Training Principles episodes at the beginning of this year. All those are kind of organized in one area. So if you're just getting into trail running and want to know the basics of where to start, go to the Training Principles tab. You can also sign up for our newsletter. We don't fill your mailbox full of junk every week or twice a week. Only when there's important things to happen, you'll also be notified when a new podcast hits the air.
So go to trailrunnernation.com.